Hello and welcome to the Oldie podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And this month we've got a fantastic piece by the former jockey and racing presenter Brough Scott. So Brough, you're talking about Boxing Day racing, which to readers who aren't racing fans is an incredibly important part of the national hunt season, isn't that right?
It is, for two reasons. One, there are a lot of meetings on Boxing Day, and two, one of the biggest races of the year, the King George VI Chase, is run at Kempton Park, just by Hampton Court on Boxing Day. But the snag for us always was, of course, if you're a jockey, you're always worrying about your weight, and Christmas dinner, therefore, has a different resonance. And certainly in the past, one of the things is very often dodgy whether or not the racing would be off. So whether or not you could indulge at Christmas was a permanent worry.
And you refer in your piece that sometimes you get a late call-up, so you have been stuffing your face and bloody hell you've got to be appearing in the 2:30 at Kempton Park, wherever it might be.
Yeah, I can remember one Christmas, and they all bother blur for all sorts of reasons, but when it was thick snow on Christmas Day, and so I indulged, and then the news came through. Remember, we didn't have phones or anything in those days, but the news came through that actually it was thawing at Huntingdon. As I was in near Cheltenham, it was a long way away, and I couldn't imagine it. But you suddenly have to realise that you put on, if you had a decent meal, you put on about 4 or 5 pounds. I was going to get it off, and I remember putting on a sweatsuit and stuff and running off round in the snow for an hour or so, and boiling and things like that. And then setting off for Huntingdon the next day, because when I got to Huntingdon, it was off again, which is, that's what you did. But nowadays, we've been, you know, as you know, climate change, it's not quite, of course, people like me always say it's not nearly as tough as it was, and men and fencing offences and all that sort of rubbish.
Well, you open your piece with some extraordinary figures on how many races were cancelled due to snow and ice, and you talk about, you didn't take part in the George VI yourself, is that right? But on the day of the George VI, having a fall on snowy, icy ground, is that right?
Yes, again, that particular year, virtually everything was off, but they kept Kempton on, even though undoubtedly nowadays it would be off. It was very, very icy. And I can remember the horse I remember, his name, it was called Palissy. It, big thing, used to gallop along his tail up and cool it away. But he fell, I mean, he really did slip up. I mean, as you know, probably that anyone listening in, that jockeys are always to blame if you back the horse and it falls, or he falls off it.
Yeah.
But this time, I really wasn't to blame, because it definitely skidded and fell. But again, perhaps we didn't know any better. But nowadays, people are so conscious of safety, and also authorities are so worried about insurance claims. If you did it now, a jockey would sue you if you were the race course. So right. We took our chances, really.
Jockeys are a fearless bunch, but pretty bloody terrifying anyway, going over jumps. But on an icy, snowy day like that, did the jockeys admit to each other in the changing room, bloody hell, it's terrifying today?
Well, you do, but to some extent, I mean, again, compared to all these sort of physical things, when you're doing it, it's kind of interesting philosophically. You can't ever be terrified. Having a bit of fear isn't a bad thing, because that makes you alert. But being terrified, petrified, i.e. actually being frozen, obviously that's what it really means, isn't it? That you mustn't be that, because that closes you down. But I mean, being a bit aware of the dangers, but I mean, in a way, well, it's like all these things, that's the challenge. After, for lots of people, it's terrifying writing an article. Well, I'm pretty terrifying, but you've got to pull yourself together and do it. And it was very satisfying to do that. And remember, it's much easier than actually climbing a mountain or something, because it's the horse is doing the jumping and galloping. So you aren't... it's only going 35 miles an hour. If you're in a car or a motorbike, you're going 100 miles an hour, and you're going to hit something solid. So you've got quite a chance on a horse.
So having said that, were you quite a daredevil? Because you describe in your article very detainingly going down to Blenheim, because you were at Oxford at the time, not so far away, and suddenly deciding to go skating on the ice. Is that right?
Well, yes, but I mean, crikey, I was 21 these days. I mean, I don't think, compared to compared to other jockeys, I didn't think I was particularly well. I definitely wasn't particularly brave or bold, but I was, you know, I was quite bold compared to all the others. You know, we were all young perhaps once. Yeah. But no, what we did have was one winter when, so I must have been about 20, so I suppose it was 1963, I forget exactly which one, 62-3, when the snow came literally on Boxing Day, and there was no racing, the day before Boxing Day, there was no racing from then until the beginning of March, the week before Cheltenham races. And it was every day, some of your Aldi readers may be awake to remember it, but every day dawned alpine clear. There was thick, thick snow. And, I mean, we went to Oxford, got down to Blenheim, and the lakes, anyone knows Blenheim, you've got those lovely lakes, they were frozen over. Well, the first one was, and then one very exciting day, I mean, we used to play ice hockey on it, but the other one was empty because it was frozen, but presumably it was reasonably thin. But I can remember one, which is you refer to, and it reminds me of that famous picture of Dr. someone or other skating near Holyrood.
Hands behind his back, yeah.
And it was empty and it was sort of getting dark. And I went under that beautiful bridge they have at Blenheim.
Yeah.
And I went as fast as I could round, consciously it might, but it was so exciting because it got Blenheim Palace up above me and a completely empty lake.
Incredible.
But again, I wanted to get myself, I remember getting, once you've done it, got halfway, I think, you know, I must get back there. I thought, if I go really fast, anyway, I did get through, so, and for all I know, it was thick, but it was interesting, no one else went on it, so perhaps I was extremely stupid.
And you're very self-deprecating in your piece about your history studies at Oxford, but quite impressive to be studying history at Oxford and also racing in first-class races. How do you manage to do that?
Well, remember, studying history is sort of pretty wishy-washy thing. I mean, I did get a degree somehow,
yes,
but anyway.
Yeah, you got in as well, yeah.
But the thing about it, in those days, if you did history, you had to pass a thing called prelims the first term, which included the dreaded Venerable Bede in Latin. But if you were still reasonably focused on study, because you just come from school, you could probably do that just about, which I did. You then couldn't actually be sent down for failing exams, because there weren't really serious exams, you could always be sick or not take them until your finals. So the time you get round to your finals, you don't really know what the syllabus is. This is appalling. I mean, you couldn't possibly do it now. I mean, lectures weren't compulsory.
Well, I did history at Oxford. There were quite a few people who did quite a similar approach. But anyway, yeah.
Anyway, the thing is that my tutor was an expert on Black Death, I remember, poor chap. And he, poor fellow, he later committed suicide, but not because of me. And he read The Guardian. In those days, The Guardian didn't have any racing. So he didn't know that I was actually riding at Newbury in places. And I had one famous day when I had an essay at 12 o'clock, and there used to be an hour. And of course, you had to fudge it like mad if you hadn't written the essay properly, like me. And the best way I found was to ask questions, express huge interest about this poor chap's interest in the Black Death.
Yeah.
And we get to about 5 to 1, and I think, fantastic, I can now go. And I'm riding in the 3 o'clock, I think, or 2:30 at Newbury, which is not that close to Oxford, but it's about a 40-minute drive. I'm just about to go. And he's so thrilled with my interest, he does the ultimate accolade of offering me a glass of sherry, which, you know, tutors did in those days. And of course, I have this glass of sherry, and he says, I'm so pleased you're so interested in it. And then he expounds something out of theory about the Black Death for another 10 minutes before I hurtle off to Newbury. And finally, I got beat on the horse.
So you made it. You made it. To the
I made it, yeah. But I finished second. And I remember the trainer grumbling a bit, and I couldn't really explain that actually the effort I made to get there deserved an accolade if I didn't win the race. But there we are.
And had you come from a racing family? I mean, you've been riding since the age of naught, had you?
No, not, and that's why I was sort of always slightly behind the curve, but I did get very keen on it, but it was a bit like, I mean, crikey, I was a war baby, so at 42 I was born, and I can remember in London after the war, which is pretty, I can tell you, pretty, London in the sort of late 40s, early 50s, pretty grey place. And my dad was interested in racing, and you know, there was a magazine, I remember, with sort of, used to have annually, the sort of the top horses and their sort of pedigrees and stuff. And slightly like boys who get keen on cricket and remember the scores and whatever. And I obviously showed interest, and my dad would ask me, and I could recite the pedigrees of horses.
Yes, yeah.
And the Queen's horses were, I mean, the Queen was a big owner, is now, but I mean, she was a big owner, and people were, the royal family was very, perhaps the Queen's horses were a big deal. Of course, the Queen was incredibly exciting. 53, she's a young woman and very glamorous. I went to the Coronation Derby, so I'd be about 9, 10, and we were up at Tapton Corner, and the Queen had a runner, which finished second. I mean, the royal colours and all that. And I can remember we had some picture. So I followed it like that.
But and
I mean,
you remember that, Devon Lochdown by the Queen Mother, is that right?
Yeah, Devon Lochdown by the Queen Mother, yeah. I remember that. That was a bit...
Were you there on that day? Were you?
No, I wasn't actually up to... By then I was at school.
Yeah.
Therefore, when I did, we lived in London, but then we got to Worcestershire, and then there were sort of ponies and things. And I actually liked the idea of sort of going fast. So then you just try and, like any sport, but you want to risk getting into the local tournament. If you play tennis, you want to...
Yeah.
And the, you know, point of points, to some extent, then we had a point of points, and it won its first race. About which I'll tell you in a minute, but basically, if you win your first race, then you're very hooked. And I was very... I didn't want to just be a sort of having a happy go. So I got rather obsessive about it all. And so I was desperately keen to, and I was riding out for a trainer and things. And when I was at Oxford, I used to drive up to Middleton Stony, where there's a man called Derek Ansell had. I'd go there every morning. So
you were on his books, as it were.
Yeah, I was sort of just it's part of the sort of team. But, you know, it was an awful waste of Oxford because, I mean, I'm getting up and going off to ride gallops when most people are going to bed, so I'm missing out on a lot of things. I sort of feel that I've missed Oxford in some ways, but still, it's
but incredibly exciting. I don't ride at all, but I've watched a bit of racing. I imagine it's an incredible thrill. Well, winning a race, tell me about that. That first point to point must have been incredible thrill.
Well, it was, but I mean, at the time it was quite competitive, everything else. But when I tell you, and there was nothing toxic about the name then, and I use the word carefully. But when I tell you that the race was the Bullingdon Club race, which I became a member of the Bullingdon Club, not because I was particularly good at throwing things through windows, but because I actually, because I by then was quite involved in sort of riding and stuff, became master of the drag hunt. Oxford drag hunt was quite a big thing then. If you were master of the drag hunt, you automatically member of the Bullingdon Club.
How funny.
But I don't remember it being particularly... I mean, crikey, my son was at Cambridge and they had sort of dining clubs and things quite recently. They were poshos, but, in a sense, they weren't really worse than anybody else. And, one or two had titles.
Yeah.
I can remember one thing on Monkey Island, was quite a nice dinner, but I don't remember them being particularly.
And I'm afraid, shamefully, I was also in it in the 90s, and it
you like wasn't disgraceful to me.
It wasn't particularly extreme. And we used to go to that point-to-point. The Bullingdon Club still goes on, doesn't it? Near the hamlet of Bullingdon, is that right?
Aston Road or something like that.
Yeah.
So
that was your first win, was at the Bullingdon point-to-point?
Yeah, exactly. And then you go on, you want to do it. You know, I was aware of that, because I hadn't been a trainer's son, been brought up in a stable yard, I was behind the ordinary guy. So I wanted to be, professional jockeys. So I was desperate to try and match myself up to them.
Because they had been doing it since they were
and that was their life thing.
Right.
But it was, to ride a thoroughbred horse, which goes 35 miles an hour and can jump, 5 foot high and 30 foot long, you are sitting on, it's basically... A galloping, jumping motorbike. And the interesting about it is, it's got to make its mind up. You can't just press controls. Sometimes you can leave it, better leaving it to decide. Sometimes you've got to help it. And sometimes you try and help it and it goes wrong. And you spend your whole time thinking about that. And I mean, jockeys talk to themselves all the time, amongst themselves, about how best to operate that horse. And the horses you really love are when they're brave, and when they're safe,
and very smooth. My grandfather was an amateur jockey, and he once
I
rode.
I know all about it.
Oh, yeah. Right, exactly. He once rode Golden Miller, and he said, I know it's a cliche, but it was like sitting in an armchair. Have you been on similar horses where they're so in control and so brilliant?
Yes.
It's a smooth ride even when you're jumping those 30 feet.
Yes, I mean, it is, again, metaphors are dangerous here, but it's if you go into cars, I mean, the real proper car is a really proper horse. It does it all really smoothly and it jumps really powerfully, whereas the ordinary horse is much more a sort of, often quite beat up things, who you're having to, you're never going to do that, they might win the race, but they're not that. And the good ones are what, you know, you go through the bad ones to ride the good ones.
Right.
I mean, you know, I was lucky and I did ride some good horses, but I mean, it didn't, in the end it was going so well as an amateur, I then had to turn professional, which was great, and I won some decent races, but it didn't go quite as well. It went much better than I could have hoped for originally. You know, but it didn't go as well as I would have dreamed of, because when I turned professional, the other chap who turned with me, Bob Davis, I mean, 2 years later, he was champion jockey and I was in hospital. So, I mean, we weren't going, our paths did not climb at the same rate.
Because you had some, like all jockeys, had some terrible falls, did you?
I had, it's a contact sport. You know, rugby players get broken legs and jockeys get broken legs and broken arms and things. And I did, I mean, again, when I turned professional, I was then, you know, I was very lucky because I was an Oxford graduate, and, you know, I'd sort of other options possibly, but a lot of them, you know, can't. But I remember thinking, I turned professional, I'll go for it, but I will refuse to accumulate injuries on my back or my head, because that's the two things I realised. I mean, without being butch about it, you can break your arm and legs or ribs and things, it doesn't matter because they hurt a bit, but they mend and you're just about as good as new. But you start accumulating your back or your head. I was lucky, I mean, I got concussed and I stopped in the end, but in truth it was actually not going anywhere probably, but I was in hospital a second time with a back problem. And to go on, people were going to say, poor old Bruff, and that would have been awfully stupid.
Does that mean you're actually holding yourself back in a certain way while you're riding to avoid those accidents, or just mean as you start to accumulate them, you just then think it's time to give up?
Well, the thing is, my feeling was when I, it's a very grand thing to say, but when I turned professional, I thought, right, I'm going to give a go, but I will say to myself, if you start getting your head injury, you're not quite sure, because I could see other people who've gone on for too long, or your back has a problem, because in the end, you know, I've had friends in wheelchairs, and you don't want to do that. And my last ride, I always said, your last ride either ought to be a winner. If it's not a winner, it should be a horse that's going to win and fell, which is what happened to me. But I can remember very clearly going to hospital in Warwick, it was, and someone, what they did, quite simple, perhaps you know, you're in trouble a bit.
They
put a wooden thing between your teeth so you can bite on it. So. But I couldn't feel my feet. And that is, you know, and I said to myself then, in the unlikely event I get out of this hole, that's definitely it. And I'm very lucky, funnily enough, without being too gory about it. I was in a cubicle in accident emergency, and it was a bit of, you know, you've got a few things inside you, so you're quite woozy. But there was quite a lot of scuffling in the next door cubicle. And a chap came in and he died. So, you know, I've been so lucky in life because, you know, frankly.
Sorry, it's another jockey.
It was another jockey. Yeah. There have been very, very few deaths, but that was one of them. But it was wonderfully exciting to do. And frankly, the achievements weren't nearly as great as if you would have been if you become, you know, to become a top footballer. I mean, the pool of competitors. Top tennis player, top rugby player, but nonetheless, it was really exciting to do it. And what you did feel, I mean, other people listening have done different things like this, you felt as if you belonged in a different world, which it was. You lived in your own capsule. You're quite different from ordinary people because they weren't going to go to Plumpton or Cheltenham or Newbury or somewhere. And you didn't, your calendar becomes entirely built around, you know, will be at the July meeting where people would have no idea what you were talking about. the King George and Cheltenham and it's Newbury that week, and people talking that sort of phrase. And how are you going to get to this? And you have ways of going. In those days, we didn't have motorways. So you were doing a lot on the train. And then trains were terrific, because race trains, you had a sort of guys and dolls, really. You had jockeys, and you had an owner, and then you'd have Spivs. Spivs was rather kind of fashion.
A few charming scoundrels as well.
Oh, yeah. And one story I have to tell you is true. I was actually on a stop riding. I was coming back from Newbury, and there was these sort of Spivs. He was around, the right was Demi Moore, isn't it, really? And you knew he'd be a bit of a villain, but he was perfectly sort of pleasant to deal with, as long as you didn't get too close to him. And I bought him a drink, because he was part of the group. And he's getting expansive. And he's clearly going to say something really nice to me. And what he said to me was, you know, you're a good guy, sort of stuff. He said, you're a good guy. If I have any trouble, Ruff, any aggro, just tell me, say the word, and. And then this brilliant phrase, it could just be a car accident.
Brilliant.
And I remember in the many years since then, there'd been the odd time when I've thought, pity that he's dead now, but we could have called him in.
Could have come and
removed somebody with a car accident. But anyway, luckily I never got into homicide.
You talk in your piece very funnily about one Boxing Day, suddenly you went to France and you could have ended up in jail. Tell that story.
I forget, 1967, 8, I think it was. 8, 9, 67, 8, I think. It's the Oldie magazine, after all.
Yeah.
Who can remember, there was foot and mouth disease, and racing was suspended for 6 weeks or something. And somewhere or other, we got about 6 horses out of England to run in France. It was absolutely brilliant. It ran down at Cannes-sur-Mer, which is a race course, which is rather, it's got rather magnificent names. It's called the Hippodrome de la Côte d'Azur. And in the morning, you ride out on the track, and you have the Mediterranean on one side, and it was a clear, cold morning, and you'd have the Alpes Maritimes on the other.
Amazing.
And I remember thinking, this is quite nice, and I've been paid to do this. So, I felt a professional jockey about it. I thought, I could have gone into a proper job, as I say, after Oxford, but here we are. I'm going right here. And there was a little chap there called Robert something, and he became very pally to us. And it will surprise anybody who knows me that I actually spoke quite a lot of French then, because I'd spent a couple of summers working in a French stables in the summer. So I had pretty good stable lad patois, as you may know. In France, French racing was entirely taken in the 1850s from England with English staff and things, and so they have le jockey, le whip, le handicap, le lad, le galop, they have all these phrases. Anyway, so I could make myself known, so I was a sort of spokesperson for our little team, and this chap Robert was very friendly to us, and he took us out, I remember, one wonderful drunkie. We went up to some place above Nice, and in fact, I nearly got killed, because there was another jockey called Stan Mellow, who was a champion jockey, unlike me, and all the jockeys went down into a sort of ring below which the rest of the world above it, and in this ring there was a little donkey, and they all sat on the donkey, and then clearly the others knew what was coming. They sort of disappeared and shoot the donkey out. And then they opened a gate, and in came, remember, we got two drinks inside us, what looked remarkably like a bull, but actually probably was a heifer or something, kept charging around. And as you know, possibly some of your listeners do, drink can do silly things to you. I happened to have on me, by complete coincidence, a scarlet cardigan, which, in an attitude of entire stupidity, Sam Mellow, who champion jockey, he got up, there's a tree in the middle of this ring, he shinned up the tree, and I stupidly waved this thing at this heifer, which sort of did it, charge it, and what I remember it doing, it went, but it hit the wooden panelling, made quite a lot of noise. I then realised this was actually extremely stupid of me. And I can't remember, I did somehow get out of it. But anyway, Robert was around, and Robert was always asking, but we had to go back after about 3 weeks. And I didn't hear from him again until about 2 years later, when he was convicted as part of an enormous plot when the mafia had actually infiltrated the whole of French racing, with him as the sort of link man. I mean, there were two killings, suicide, and about five of the top 10 jockeys went to jail. It's absolutely extraordinary.
And you explain in the piece, is it right that the most fancied horses ended up at the back?
In the race, it was a very famous race. It was called the pre-breed aperture, and it remains probably the most corrupted race that's ever been run in the history of horse racing. Because the big track in France jumping is Auteuil, which some people may know, which is literally next to the Roland Garros tennis, the top of the Bois de Boulogne, right next to the 16th district. And Auteuil racetrack is a beautiful track, actually, but French hardly ever go to it, it's a huge track. And the big race of the day was a big handicap with something like 26 runners. And by then, and the idea that the French big bet in France was one of these trifecta things, called the tier thing, where you have to have the first three, so you get a permutation. The trick is, where there's a really big dividend, is if three outsiders come up. And this particular day,
same again,
the race had been going for about two fences, and visually something extraordinary happened, because the race was split into two groups. There was about five at the front, six at the front, and then literally 50 yards behind there was another group of whatever it was, 15. And this just looked most peculiar. And even more peculiar, if you looked at the race card, you discovered that the only ones in the front were outsiders. And this went on, and people sort of slightly jeered, and then when they jumped the last hurdle, I mean, the others all kept shooting up and finished for fifth, sixth, seventh. And I mean, it looked appalling, and everyone knew something was happening. And then they went in, and then, again, it was very, very messy.
And they'd overcooked it, hadn't they?
They had overcooked it. And, you know, I've always thought that if Robert, we'd been a bit more in Robert, I might have been spending time at the French president's leisure.
Luckily, I
escaped.
And you're very self-deprecating, but you'd actually have more than 100 winners. But notwithstanding that, you talk about having raced alongside champion jockeys, including Peter Scudamore's father, is that right?
Yes, there's a book out, plug-in book I've been published this year, which is actually, I will remember it, called Three of a Kind, but it's Peter Scudamore, who's a champion jockey 8 times. His son, Tom, now, is a very leading jockey. Funny, how very funny, you ought to get him on your podcast, very funny chap. And he's about 35, so he's a veteran jockey. And Peter's father, Tom's grandfather, is called Michael Scudamore. And actually he, before he died, about 4 years, was a schoolmaster who put him on tape. Everyone should do with their old relatives. Don't sit to write a book, put them on tape. And using that, and then interviewing Peter and Tom, there's this witness to the past. But no, I mean, Michael Scudamore had won the Grand National. He was sort of a bit of a hero to me because we used to go off on the trains and things. He was from near me. And you could realise how sort of tough he was. And the thing I remember very much, physical things, is that, of course, you're trying to get sort of fit and tough in your 20 or 21. But you can't get hands like his out of doing a few press-ups. You know, he got hands, proper leather. I mean, proper, and also a handshake, which he doesn't have to try, but you clearly know that he's stronger than you.
Well, I was going to ask, what did any champion jockey have that you didn't, given you had more than 100 winners in races?
People get 100 winners now by Christmas, in the top ones. But to be fair, there weren't quite as many races then. But then what they had that I didn't have, besides being probably tougher than me, but it is that the real champions had more winning flair and a bit more determined too. You know, really
Sorry, but what does winning flair mean?
Well, winning flair is what it means is, if you think of other sports, it's actually someone who's going to read what you should do better. In football, it's the person who does a better pass, sees the picture better, sees where to go better, reads it better. Cricketers, reading the spin better. Reading it better, and the particular reading, of course, you have a skill set. Horse racing is several different things, but at the sort of intellectual level, it's galloping chess. It's a galloping card game, but the horse's abilities is your set of cards. It's a question of how you play it. And you can lose a good hand, and you can absolutely, I can remember very clearly a couple of times when I did, it really irritated me. You could win this, but if you move too soon, you've played your trump. And, you go clear and the horse stops. And it's used its momentum and it won't go any further, won't go any faster, and someone catches you.
And vice versa. So often as a betting man, you've got your bet on the favourite, it's quite far back, and they leave it too late, don't they? And they put the foot on the gas and it...
One of the sort of optical illusions is many, many more races are lost by coming too soon than too late.
How funny, yes. Because you think about the other one more often, don't you?
And that looks visual, but you often... they couldn't get going early enough, and then remember, it's the end of a horse race, unlike an athletics race, is almost always an optical illusion, because it looks as if the horse overtaking is sprinting and quickening. If you actually get into the sort of anorak detail, the last furlong is almost always the slowest, because they're slowing down. What the overtaking horse is doing is producing an extra surge of energy.
Because they're exhausted.
The other ones are tiring, yeah. Because remember the big problem with why I actually believe in discretionary use of the whip, because the horse does not know where the winning post is.
Really, he doesn't, athlete, can't see the...
Yeah, but he doesn't know, he
has been round once already, often.
But he doesn't sort of... I have great affection and respect for horses, but they're horses. An athlete knows, even the thickest athlete knows where the winning post is. He knows it's four laps from a mile. Yeah. The horse doesn't. And you're saying you've got another 100 yards to go, and I want you now. That's where I think sort of the jockey's about. But no, there's a galloping card game, and then there's the other skill set, which is the actual reading of the athlete beneath you. Does this horse, you come to a fence, does this horse want to be encouraged or left alone or steadied? And that's what you've got to make a decision all the time. I mean, you're often better just sitting quietly, but you need, in perfect world, momentum. And now you'll get people, McCoy, who's just retired, the most successful jockey ever. I mean, his basic deal was commitment. He believed he really had to commit, that he was prepared to commit in a way, particularly early on, people terrify people, because he'd be saying, anyone's done school sports, to lengthen your stride to jump a hurdle rather than shorten your stride. I mean, the safer way is to shorten up. But he would commit, and I can remember standing at a hurdle race early on these days with Ruby Walsh, who's a brilliant jockey. And he was on a horse that was favoured in any way, and there wasn't a runner, the hurdle race. And he came to the second hurdle in front of us, and he could have just gone and jumped it. And he went 1, 2, 3, whoosh, and the horse came up a long way, and he just got there. And you're thinking, crikey.
Thus meaning he had many more falls as well as a result.
Not really, because in many ways you're better off, as with most of the sports, you're better off if you're committed. The time you get hurt, I mean, everyone will tell you this, especially rugby, is when you're half committed. You're a bit iffy, and the horse is undecided. You're better off deciding. And then, frankly, if you're very committed and you go and the horse falls, you're going to be fired. It's when you're sort of sitting back a bit,
So it's a confidence thing, is that right?
Confidence, it's reading what the horse underneath you. The horse may not be able to take it if you bully him. But then the other hand, if you leave him alone, he may just jump a bit too carefully. So you've got to read it. And that's the great fascination. You often ride a horse you've never sat on before. But you have conversations with lots of different people. And they tend to fit into types. And very quickly you realise that they, you know, they're rather reticent and you have to coax them, or they're very garrulous and you have to try and calm them and whatever. And the horses fit into types. But you hope you can balance around them. You know, you've got to adjust yourself. And it's a dancing partner.
Did that mean, my dad says the only time he's ever made any money on the races, he went with his father, then a retired jockey, into the changing room, and his father, who knew all these jockeys, said, "Who's going to win?" And they all said, "Oh, it'll be two big boy in the 230, you know, little girl in the 310." That actually, you have a pretty good idea.
No. You. The fact is, if that was so, all jockeys make a fortune betting, even though they're not allowed to.
You might have got lucky. You
know, the likelihood that, unless you've got my friend Robert, made it all crooked, you pull up all the other horses. The idea is only one horse that's capable of winning. You know, you can say so and so has got the best chance, but then, you know, particularly nowadays with all sort of data and everything else, that's why it's favourite. You know. But you get situations where a horse has been away for a time, or it's now at long last got its better going, or it's had an operation or something, and he's really good at home, and this we're really pleased with him. But a huge extent, I used to do quite a bit of sports writing, and the thing I remember is going to boxing gyms before a big fight, and you'd have to talk to the trainer, and he'd say, "Oh, this chap, he's got himself reorganised now, and he's X, Y, and Z, he's in better shape than ever been." Because they're going to believe it. Then afterwards you find he gets beaten, he says, "Oh, well, he's got a bad leg or something." And they're going to believe, and you need to believe. I mean, I remember Coy said once that he'd get himself into a state of mind that when he's down at the start, he'd believe he could win. Rather than, "I was just going to go around." And of course,
even on a bad horse, even
about, if you knew, I can make this win somehow or other. Because, I mean, every horse has got a chance in a race somehow or other. Either it means that one's got to fall first, but I can do something. And the fun is to try and make it do, you know, do the thing. It can, it's usually got, it's got a bit of ability somewhere. What is it that's going to click for it? And again, will the rhythm of the race work for it? Which is the other huge thing. If it gets into its own sort of pattern of galloping. And of course, most of all, if it jumps well. Because if you stop jumping badly, then you break your rhythm and it's all a struggle and everything else. But it was an exciting time.
Wonderful. And having said that, an invidious question, but was there one particular horse, famous or not, that you rode that stands out for being exceptional?
Yes, I mean, not that people would remember, but I had one horse who was very good on the day, and he then had heart problems and didn't become very good. And it was very nice for me because I'd been injured and broken an arm, and I I do it now, but I had the arm sort of splinted up with a big plus on here. And my right arm, so I remember break before I had to write with your left hand. If you're right-handed, it's jolly hard to ride your left hand. Anyway, this horse was called Persian Empire, and I'd won his first race on him, and he was very impressive, and he was much better than the ordinary hurdle. He'd been a very good horse on the flat. And he ran in what was then a very big hurdle race called the Imperial Cup. And
which you won, you'll probably do.
And the thing about this is that I'd been in hospital, and I was convinced that this horse would win it, because he was much classier. And what I remember about that was, and his only problem is he only run three times over hurdles. So it was a question of whether he'd not get involved in the race and his inexperience might get him in trouble jumping. So what I did was drop him out last, on the understanding that his speed would pick him up. And the pity is I can't use any video record of it, but it was, what I remember about it was the one time when, and it was quite a big spotlight, his favourite and everything else, I dropped it at last, and then coming round the back straight at Sandown, I was cutting through them, as you know, get into easy cliches of knife through butter and stuff, and it was just a question, talking about the playing cards, you know, I knew I had the trumps, and not getting there too soon, and I could take everything in front of me, and that was a really lovely thing, moving, and of course you're not, you could delay, but what I usually find is that you're very dangerous over hurdles, because there's usually a furlong, half a furlong left, which is quite a bit of distance, I mean, 150 yards or so. But if you, because later you become the better, but if you wait till after the last hurdle and it then doesn't jump the last hurdle well, there's suddenly there's a gap and the horse can panic and you can't do it. You it gets in the muzzle. But I remember coming there and joining the other leader at the last hurdle and winning nicely. And in a way, it's an old Sinatra song of they can't take that away from me. And it's that's I have that memory which I can treasure to my untimely grave.
And you had at certain moments been holding back even while you were the night.
I was holding all the time. I had this. What you have is like that. On your hand, you have the knife. The knife is what you're going to put past the leader. It's a lovely, lovely feeling. You can feel yourself. You're going better than the ones in front. You can see all the other. When you're a jockey, you get an expert, and I use the words carefully here, on other jockeys' backsides. Because you're studying jockeys' backsides. You know when they're beginning to have to work their horse. And you can get jockeys a bit deceptive. The horses, they are moving more with their arm, but you suddenly begin to see them having to move, and their backside comes down, and they have to push.
More than the whip, is it?
Because basically, well, the whip times, they're getting desperate, but it's before that. You say, he's not going. So, and also, if you know he's going to be coming back, you have this, it's like flotsam coming back at you. If he's going to be in trouble, you don't want to be in his way as he comes back. You need to move out. Traffic, I mean, it is like going through traffic. When you decide, should I switch lanes? The traffic. It's terribly interesting. You move out and then the traffic in front of you slows down. And anyone watches racing can see that. And suddenly it's all a mess. And
you get boxed
if you
in,
read it right, you read your way through. And really good job is read your way through well. But it was all a long time ago.
Yeah. And then you became presenter in 1971, is that right?
I suppose so, yes, 71. Yes, I think so. It was 71 because I was still... I think I stopped, 1970, I started doing some business in 2070 when I was still riding. And then 71, I did do the Derby because Holcombe Millreath won it. And I remember doing an interview with on top of what was in the tote stand, with Jimmy Tarbuck, who's still with us, which is incredibly nice of him because I was sort of junior member of the TV team. And, I was hanging on by my fingers because I didn't know anything about television or whatever, but I sort of pretended I could do things, and so I was on the Derby team. They said, "Well, we need to get a celebrity on and do an interview with him." So I didn't know any celebrities, but the person I did know was Des O'Connor, who was very famous then.
Still is, yeah.
Is he still with us, Des?
Yes, he is.
Anyway. And he, funnily enough, he got very keen on racing. He'd actually ridden in a race somewhere. And I'd known him, and he was a friend. So I rang him up, and I went to see him. And my memory was, he was in his dressing room at Palladium. I went to see him and said, "Look, this is a score. I've got this thing, ITV, and they say I've got to do an interview at the Derby. But I need a showbiz person. I don't know anybody." But he couldn't do it. He said, "Oh, I'll get someone." And then he said, "Okay, Jimmy Tarbuck will do it." And I remember the TV people saying, "Well, where's Jimmy Tarbuck?" I don't know. And we were getting about a minute to go. I thought, crikey, what's going to happen? And fair to Jimmy Tarbuck appeared. So in dark glasses, looking rather grumpy. And he came up. And, people have, whatever anyone said to Jimmy Tarbuck, I'll never have a word against him because he was absolutely sweet and very nice. And of course, if you've had no broadcasting training, you needed people to help you, and he did. So fair dues to Jimmy Tarbuck.
But also, like people say, people shouldn't be theatre critics unless they've been actors. That you must have had an extra string to your bow. The fact that you'd been a jockey, that then when you're presenting, as well as knowing the calendar, as you referred to earlier on, you really know it to a deeper level than a presenter who hasn't.
Yeah, but I mean. Again, I don't mean to too much false modesty, but the fact is that at that stage, which was 1970-71, there were no such thing as ex-athletes, ex-pros broadcasting. And in fact, it, what sort of started me, 1970 World Cup, ITV had a sort of panel, and they include sort of Paddy Crim and Malcolm Allison, who were ex-pros, and they talked in football argo. Up till then, people were sort of old colonels and things, or journalists, but they weren't pros, and they sort of said, we're getting up and down the park and stuff, and no one ever used these words. I remember, obviously, because that particular summer, 1970, I'd broken my leg quite badly, so I was a lot of time sitting, and I watched everything, every single part of the World Cup, World Cup in Mexico.
Yeah.
We had a very good team, rather unlucky to get beat anyway. And I thought, and also I was realising, look, you can't go on like this. What happens if you break your leg next year? What's your plan B? I hadn't got a plan B, and sort of thought about that. Originally I was going to be a trainer. Then I knew I hadn't got the sort of right personality to be a trainer. I wouldn't be like a gardener. I was too sort of butterfly minded. So I knew something else. And I watched obviously the racing, and then I thought they were all fine, but there weren't any ex jockeys. And so I rang up Julian Wilson, who was there, and said, look, I knew him quite well, sort of I could do this. And he gave me a trial, and the BBC put me on, and in a way I got away with it. And I'm not being funny here, because if you do, as anybody who's been sort of stuck somewhere within those prison camps, if you have to broadcast, after a bit you get used to it. And I realised I'd got nothing else going, and I spent first sort of year or so, perhaps 6 months, if you can't be good, be different. I had no broadcasting experience, I wasn't in the school play, I think I once did a declamation, so I don't have a very good voice, you know. You realise once you start listening to your own voice, its limitations, but...
But then, for the reasons you've been saying, you were unusual having been...
So I could say things that they couldn't say, because I just said obvious things, like this horse has got covered in sweat, and that's why he's wearing gloves. People weren't saying that before. This horse has got a crossover that he pulls up. People then didn't say that. And, of course, that was quite nice, so I was sort of hired for that. And then if you do enough experience, then you begin to find ways of working around... You begin to know the disciplines of broadcasting, just like anyone who gets stuck with writing has to learn the disciplines very painfully of journalism. Of suddenly, instead of writing 3,000 words of sort of bills, you've got 300 words. And you know, the first paragraph is the most important one. It's rather different from history essays.
Well, that's an extremely good point to stop, because you've written an absolutely marvellous article for the Christmas edition of The Oldie, and I'm very grateful to Bruff Scott for appearing on the Christmas podcast of The Oldie. Thanks so much, Bruff.